This is Chris. The show is Peace and Justice. That is a takeoff on the Rihanna Umbrella song on the ICANN website, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And we will be speaking to somebody from ICANN in a moment. Before I go to my first guest, I would like to just update you that the Dixie Fire incident update has not updated for the last 2 hours or before that from 7 o'clock this morning. So there's really no new information regarding the size of the fire, the extent of the spread. But we are here at KZFR. We are trying to monitor the fire, and we'll break in if there's any new news. So I have on the line with me Toby Blomé. She is an activist of a rare character, someone who just never stops. She is with Code Pink Bay Area and Occupy Beale Air Force Base and Shut Down Creech. And we have a couple of things that we wanted to bring to you today because of the sentencing hearing for a man named Daniel Hale. Whistleblower Edward Snowden said, "Daniel Hale is one of the most consequential whistleblowers. He sacrificed everything, an incredibly courageous person. To tell us that the drone war is happening and 90% of the casualties in the 1 5-month period were innocents or bystanders are not the target of the drone strike. We could not establish that. We could not prove that without Daniel Hale's voice." So, Toby Blomé, welcome to the Peace and Justice Program. Who is Daniel Hale?
Yeah, hi, Chris. Thank you for inviting me. Daniel Hale is, in my eyes, one of the most important figures in the 21st century. He's one amongst other important figures like Edward Snowden and Julian Assange, who and many whistleblowers in the last decade that have been prosecuted for crimes. Well, Snowden hasn't been prosecuted because he's hiding away in Russia. But these are people that are committed to, have taken risks on for themselves to release important information to the public so that we can know what our government's doing, the crimes our government's committing. And Daniel Hale was in the Air Force. He was working as an intelligence analyst, and he wasn't directly involved in operating drones or firing missiles, but he was heavily involved in the assassination program because he helped the people who are firing those Hellfire missiles from drones. He helped them target individuals, helped them identify and track where they are. So what he did, which is so brave, is he was very troubled by what he was seeing. He knew that civilians were being killed. He knew that people who were being killed that he didn't even know who they were because they happened to be in the vicinity. As he participated more, he was disturbed. He ultimately got out of the Air Force and was working for a private company that had access to really important intelligence documents that proved, they were military documents that proved that that indeed a high percentage of people were being killed that were either civilians or unintended targets, including in a 5-month period in Afghanistan. 90% of the people that were killed by U.S. drones were the unintended target. So he took a lot of risk. He was, after releasing those documents, they were printed in the drone papers. You can actually Google the drone papers, and The Intercept published those papers. That's the title of their report. And it opened a very secret covert program that we knew about, and we knew civilians were being killed, but we didn't know the degree. We didn't know the role of Beale Air Force Base exactly or Creech Air Force Base fully until those papers were released. So it really unveiled a very secret program and helped us understand it more. And so he ultimately faced a trial actually this year in April. He was going to have a trial, and just days before his trial, the court offered him a plea deal with the prosecutors agreeing. And if he agreed to being guilty, then his sentence risk would be reduced from up to 50 years. If he didn't take the plea deal to 10 years or less. So his lawyers advised him that because the court is so rigged and he wouldn't be able to have a fair trial, that it was better for him to accept the plea deal. But the problem is his sentence is on July 27th, his sentencing hearing, and he doesn't know what he's going to get, but the prosecuting attorneys are asking, the DOJ, the Department of Justice, is asking for 9 years. I don't know what the judge will do. There's been a huge letter-writing campaign. I've written a letter to his judge. Many people have written letters asking for the judge for leniency, that Daniel Hale is a hero. He shouldn't be in prison right now. He should be freed. Please show leniency. Drop the charges. We're awaiting anxiously to see. A lot of people have written to Daniel Hale. Some of us have gotten letters back from him while he's in prison. He loves to get letters from people. And you can go to standingwithdanielhale.org, and there's a whole list of ways you can support him, and at this point it's too late to write a letter to the judge because the sentencing is on Tuesday. But there, you can make calls to the Department of Justice, you can try to communicate to the White House. It's horrible that we are living in a country that prosecutes whistleblowers. We used to have protections against whistleblowers, and since the Obama administration, sadly a Democratic president, whistleblowers have been prosecuted on a very, very regular rate. Under Obama, more whistleblowers were prosecuted than any other previous presidents combined. That's what changed under the Obama administration. And this pattern is getting worse. Julian Assange has been in jail for several years and was held up in the Ecuadorian embassy because he worried about persecution by United States, extradition to the United States in Britain. So it's a sad times we live in. Our freedoms are being assaulted left and right wherever we go. Yeah. And we need to stand up for Daniel Hale.
So, Toby Blome, I wanted to just fill in a couple of blanks here that he didn't meet investigative reporter Jeremy Scahill until 2013. And in 2014, the FBI came to his home and stripped his house of all of the electronics. And then he was in a limbo for 5 years almost until he was charged under the Espionage Act with 4 counts of violating the Espionage Act and 1 count of theft of government property. Can you tell us about the Espionage Act and how this applies to him?
Yeah, well, the Espionage, you probably know more than I do, Chris, but the Espionage Act was something that was set up in the early part of the 1900s, and it's written in a way that's supposed to be like a legal action taken against traitors or spies that leak information to foreign countries, etc. But how it's actually been used, and my understanding is from the very beginning of its inception, was to persecute people who are whistleblowers and such. So it's an act that's very abused and misused to make people afraid to come forward and reveal, expose truth to the public that the public has a right to know. And Daniel Hale was aware of, I'm sure, very well aware of the Espionage Act, but in spite of that, he took risk upon himself because he felt the American public should know about the serious crimes against humanity committed by the U.S. Drone assassination program. And I honor him so much for his courage, as you stated, Edward Snowden's words. There's another quote I have from Edward Snowden, and it really speaks for me. He said, when exposing a crime is treated as committing a crime, you are being ruled by criminals. Mm-hmm. And that says it all to me. Like, I can't even get excited about the democratic process of voting much anymore. Not that I don't vote. Of course I do. But many of our top officials are criminals. If you look deep enough, they sometimes say the nice words, make them sound like they care about us. But if you look at their actions, they are criminals. So, and I think a lot of us listening probably, and other people around the country have known this for a long time. But when you see that we're actually putting whistleblowers and journalists in prison, like Julian Assange, it's really a serious business. It's an assault on our press freedom. It's an assault on our rights, our free speech rights, everything, you know, that we can think of.
Right. And, this legislation that was written and used during World War I, during Woodrow Wilson's administration, continues to be used to threaten and silence whistleblowers. And so one of the ways that we can be involved is to rid ourselves of this legislation, because it's only whistleblowers that let us know about actions that are like extrajudicial executions that are illegal under the drone strikes, and then also many of the things about the proliferation of drone sales around the world. And at this is a time, too, when President Biden continues to launch drone attacks. Just yesterday, they launched drone attacks against the Taliban. And according to Daniel Hale, many of these people are not Taliban, who they will have killed yesterday. So, Toby Blume, some of the key resources, you mentioned some about writing to the judge, writing to Daniel, and then, of course, writing to President Biden to ask him to pardon Daniel Hale. What about films like National Bird? Do you want to mention those?
Oh, sure. National Bird is the best documentary about the U.S. drone program that I have ever seen. I think it came out in 2015, 2016, and it features three whistleblowers in the drone program. Daniel Hale was one of them. So if you really want to get to know him intimately, his spirit, his being, and two other whistleblowers, women who were in the drone program working at Diehl Air Force Base, where we have our protest against the U.S. drone program. And it's a really powerful film, but it also shows it recreates this incident in Afghanistan in, I believe it was 2010, where three cars were traveling on the highway, and some U.S. drones were surveilling them, and they just got some idea because there were three cars in a caravan, then therefore they must be terrorists. And in fact, it was just members of an extended family in three cars, including many children. And so they fired missiles on this caravan, and what's so shocking is the filmmakers got hold of... are you still there, Chris?
Yeah, still here.
Okay. Okay, I heard a little click, so I was... What was really troublesome in the film is that the filmmakers got a hold of the conversation of the people that were getting ready to strike these people in the cars. And it's just... tears your heart out to see how casually these people who are in the Air Force and other people working within the system care so slightly about these human lives. Mm. And I can't remember the exact words, but it tears your heart out to know that the people that are so careless about protecting life have the controls to kill people from thousands of miles away. And that's why these whistleblowers at Beale, these two women, one was in the program that actually helped oversee and try to minimize the killing of civilians in the drone program. And she reported in the film that repeatedly, over and over again, the department that she worked in to report to the operators before they fired the missiles to let them know that, no, this is not, that you should not fire those missiles. There's civilians present. They wouldn't listen to the people in the apartment. They would continue on their mission, and they would fire these missiles in spite of warnings. And that's all revealed in this really important film, National Bird.
Yeah. Another one I'd like to mention that is fairly new is called bankillerdrones.org. It represents an international grassroots campaign working to ban aerial weaponized drones and military and police drone surveillance. So that is a really important one. I wanted to ask you, Toby Blume, about Beale Air Force Base and an action that you have coming up on the day of Daniel Hale's sentencing.
Yeah, this July 27th, some of us who live far away, we're actually going to come up the night before, but we're going to have a morning and afternoon vigil at Beale Air Force Base in the morning during the commute hours, in the morning between 6 and 8, and in the afternoon between 3 and 5. And in the morning, we're asking activists who feel comfortable and prepared to join us in a peaceful, nonviolent direct action at Beale. I don't want to give any details over the radio, but if you join us at we call it the Wheatland Gate. It's at the corner of South Beale Road and Ostrom Road. That's where the vigil will take place. And if you don't feel comfortable risking arrest, we highly need support people holding banners, signs, being there to make sure we're safe. And and typically over the last many years, what happens when we have a direct action like that at Beale, they take us onto the base, they hold us for a couple hours at the most usually, and sometimes it's just for an hour. They give us a citation and they release us, and then ultimately the charges are dropped. We never have a trial. I think the purpose is they really want to keep it out of public attention. So if we have a trial, we get public attention on this horrible, these horrible policies and program, the U.S. drone assassination program. So we welcome people to come to Beale. It's right near Marysville. And you can email me at Toby, T-O-B-Y, the number 4, P-E-A-C-E, peace, Toby for peace, at sonic.net. And I will send you information. We need to step up. You know, when you think of the risks that Daniel Hale took and that he might be serving a 9 or 10 year prison sentence, as Edward Snowden said, he took it was an astonishing act of civil courage. And I feel like this influences us. We need to listen to our responsibility as U.S. citizens, that, you know, the crimes of our government are getting worse and worse with each decade. And we need to show really strong civil courage to step up, stand with Daniel Hale, stand in the road at Beale Air Force Base, which is intimately involved in the drone program, and say, no, we will not take this anymore. We need to put our bodies on the line, just like the civil rights workers did in the 60s. You know, they rode the freedom buses. Right. They sat at the lunch counters. That's what changed a society. We're not going to change it unless we find the courage in ourselves to do more.
Toby Blume is our guest today on the Peace and Justice Program, and one of the projects that she has been most well known for is for Shutdown Creech. Creech Air Force Base is probably one of the greatest purveyor of illegal remotely controlled assassinations with their Predator drones. And Toby, we have 3 minutes left for you to tell us about Shutdown Creech, please.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Chris. It's been going on since 2009, when some faith-based activists actually did the first action at a drone base in 2009. At Creech, and they crossed the line, and they had an amazing trial. That's a story in itself. And then ever since then, Code Pink has been going down to support this movement. So they led the way for us, but we've been having protests at Creech twice a year, and it's really grown into a week-long protest. And now we have Veterans for Peace, an amazing organization of veterans working for peace, that co-sponsor it with us again. we really want to build it up. We had, in 2015-16, we had 150 people or more from states all across the country, as far as Maine and Alaska joining us. And we want to build it up. The executive director of Veterans for Peace is very excited and really going to try work hard to get younger vets to be involved. And we have the next action in the fall, September 26th through October 2nd. You don't have to come for the whole week. You can come for a couple days. You can go to shutdowncreech, CREECH.org, to get all the information, shutdowncreech.org. Oh, no, excuse me, shutdowncreech.blogspot.org. If you just put in Shutdown Creech, usually it shows up. And Creech Air Force Base, as Chris said, is one of the key drone control bases that kills innocents. And the military works with the CIA, so it's a CIA-directed drone base. So you know the crimes of the CIA if you're listening to Chris's station here. So we welcome you. It's very exciting. It's growing. We're getting the webinar that we had last night got people excited. We've got more people reaching out saying they're coming. So I think it's going to be a really big turnout. You can stay in Las Vegas. It's an hour away from Creech, and the place that we stay at is called the Goddess Temple, a really beautiful place in the desert that we camp at. We're going to do camping only because of the pandemic. We want to keep our activities outdoors, wearing masks when we're close to each other just to play it safe. And, I left my email address. Please write me or go to the website. It has all of our contact information. Bring friends, bring relatives. Help us grow this effort to stop this very illegal and immoral program, the U.S. drone program.
So, Toby Bome, you gave us your email. Can you repeat it again so that if people want directions to Beale Air Force Base, I know it was on the announcement.
Sure. It's Toby, 4-Peace, the number 4, T-O-B-Y, number 4, P-E-A-C-E, at sonic.net.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for all your work, and I appreciate very much the webinar from yesterday. Is that online somewhere? Because that was excellent.
Yeah, thank you so much. It is recorded, and actually the Veterans for Peace National is going to post it. They have their convention coming up in August, but we will have the recording of it as well. We can distribute to people who want to share it with people. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to access it at this point, but I would bet within a week or two I'll be able to share it with people. She can write to me about that.
Thank you so much for being my guest on the Peace and Justice program, and thank you for everything you do, amazing person.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
All right. See you Tuesday. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So this is the Peace and Justice program. Sorry I do not have the ability to check on the Dixie Fire right now, but you can go to the CAL FIRE website if you have the ability to, and also if you're on Twitter, at CAL FIRE _Butte County, and just Google Dixie Fire, too, if you can. But this is the Peace and Justice program, and I wanted to just make one announcement before we do our top of the hour business, a couple of them. At Comanche Creek, at least, there is very little water. The water fountain there barely works. So we're doing another Chico Community Water Drive at the Hands tomorrow, the Hands 4th and not Flume, Wall Street, behind the City Council building, from 9 to 11 on Saturday. So if you want to buy some water or bring ice chests or misters or anything you can, this is going to be another very hot weekend. People, there is a safe space cooling center, but many people cannot get there. They're afraid to leave their possessions due to the risk of threat. And so a lot of people just hunker down during these hot days, and they don't have water. So this is a humanitarian crisis, and I urge you to give water if you can, in whichever way you can, tomorrow, 9 o'clock at the Hands. All right, so let me do one more announcement. On the evening of, let's see, I don't even have the date here. That's great. So there's going to be a wonderful film with Trudy Duesenberg's film Norm, about Norm Dillinger, a pointillist artist here in Chico, whose vehicle you may have seen driving around. He is an actual joy to know about. So you'll want to see this film called Norm. But also, Respectful Revolution has been doing a film called Lost and Found in the Park, Finding Community in Chico's Homeless Camps. It's a 50-minute feature, and it focuses on intimate conversations with some of our neighbors who are currently living unhoused. And this is really important that's coming up. And there'll be some spoken word performance also. And, of course, I do not have the date, but it's coming up this coming week, so be watching for that. I believe it's the 27th, but so don't call because I can't pick it up. I'm sorry about that. So this is a Peace and Justice program. We have rotating hosts. We're here with you every Friday from 11:30 to 1. And I want to thank our underwriters this time. Thanks to all of you generous contributors due to KZFR, you supporters. I hope that you'll weigh in on Best of Chico on the News and Review. I want to thank Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open daily on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And also want to thank Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when it's available at the Thursday night market and the Saturday farmers market. For more information, you can visit chicovelo.org, and you can find them on Facebook. Also want to thank regional and continuing education at Chico State, offering online graduate test preparation courses for those seeking an advanced degree in a wide range of fields, including law and business. Sign up for a complimentary strategy session to help you prepare to take the GRE, the GMAT, LSAT at rce.csuchico.edu. And also want to thank Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding our listeners to think for themselves but drink with others. So if you enjoy the KZFR shows, please tip them, including this one. Thank you. All right. So I want to just tell you that it is coming up on noon. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, a listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The opinions voiced on the program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters, just myself and my guests. I'm going to get our next guest on the line here. And let's do some music. Here we go.
A woman stepped on a bus like any one of us after a hard working day. She walked halfway back to a seat marked for blacks and took her place. She was someone who really understood how a law could be a crime. When she wouldn't give her seat to a white man on his feet, yeah. Change. Many years before, another place, another war, in the struggle to be free. own plan to fight the enemy. He said it makes no sense to use violence as a means to an end. And we must rise above what they would do to us, or we become like them. So be the change you want to see around you. Be the rise.
That song is Facets of Folk, Mara Levine. And I hope I have on the line with me Ray Atchison. Just want to check. Ray, you there?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm here.
Good. Let me intro you. Ray Atchison is the director of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom's Disarmament Program in New York City. Ray leads the organization's work on stigmatizing war and violence, advocating and organizing for disarmament, and raising feminist perspectives on militarism and weapons. Ray represents Women's International League for Peace and Freedom within the International Steering Group of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which we will be referring to as ICAN, which won the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. Ray has been awarded the 2020 Nuclear Free Future Award and was also gotten many other awards, 2018 UN Women Metro New York Champion of Change Prize. Ray is the author of a recently published book from Roman and Littlefield called Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy. And Ray was my guest on the day that the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons went into force on January 22nd, 2021, and I will post that archive so you can hear more from Ray Atchison. Thank you for coming back on the Peace and Justice Program, and congratulations on your book, Ray.
Thank you so much for having me on the show again.
Yeah, I would love to hear step by step some of the intricacies of what you brought up in your book, because you were such a close participant and leader during these negotiations to ban nuclear weapons, and this has gotten no press that I know of, and so it's really important, I think, for people to know some of the contents of your book, because I've never seen a history that is so lovingly portrayed. You know, you really it's just a wonderful book. It just completely pulls you along, and even though there's so much detail to it, I'd like to ask you first about nuclear deterrence. This has been the nuclear weapon states and those countries who feel protected by them or loyal to them have been using nuclear deterrence since Hiroshima and Nagasaki back in 1945. Tell us about nuclear deterrence and what it the stranglehold it held on the world for so long.
Yeah, absolutely. So nuclear deterrence is really nothing more than a theory. It's the idea that the possession of nuclear weapons prevents other countries from attacking you or challenging you. And an international sphere grants you, you know, geopolitical power and strategic sort of power in the world of international relations. And it treats nuclear weapons as if they are not weapons As if they're tools for peace and security in the world. But in reality, nuclear weapons only cause grave harm. And the thing that nuclear deterrence theory misses, and those espousing nuclear deterrence theory completely ignore, is this harm that nuclear weapons have generated around the world. So whether that's from, you know, the uranium mining and other production aspects of nuclear weapons and the contamination of land and water that's resulted from that, around the United States and the Soviet Union and in other places where nuclear weapons production happens, or whether it's the testing that took place for decades around the world, atmospheric testing and underground testing that resulted in basically the entire world being affected by radioactive fallout, and in particular where the areas where the bombs were tested, resulting in extreme harm to local populations throughout the Pacific Islands, in Australia, in the southwestern United States, in Kazakhstan, and in other places where nuclear bombs have been tested. And then, of course, there's the radioactive waste storage and the fact that we still don't have a system for long-term radioactive waste storage and all the leakages and accidents that have occurred and that can occur in the future. So they're very destructive tools, even if they aren't being used, and I put used in quotation marks to mean, you know, used in terms of armed conflict. Even without that, they're extremely harmful, but nuclear deterrence whitewashes all of that and says that they're tools of peace and security. And so that discourse is really dominated in mainstream ideology around these weapons. A lot of people, you know, kind of have a natural reaction against nuclear weapons. They understand that they're bad, but they think that they're necessary, some kind of necessary evil, when really this is just a construct that the nuclear weapon producers and the governments that benefit from the perceived power it gives them have. It's a myth, a narrative that's been spun for so many years, and it's really prevented a lot of determined action against these weapons.
So, Ray Acheson, your sound is a little off, so if you could hold that mic by your mouth and not have a speakerphone or a headset, I think it might be better because there's distracting lisping sound. Ray Acheson is the author of Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, and they are intimately concerned with these issues. And one of those was that we've been held hostage, as I said earlier, by this deterrence theory. And those of us who have been anti-nuclear activists have always believed in that, you know, humanitarianism is the most important. And Ray mentioned some of that, but how did the world come together to finally say, you know, the humanitarian approach is what we're going to use in order to ban these weapons? What is the humanitarian initiative, and how did it work?
Yeah, the humanitarian initiative is something that was sort of formed from 2010 to really elevate the humanitarian and environmental concerns of nuclear weapons within the international community. So at the level of governments and diplomats and other officials that are concerned with these weapons. The vast majority of countries in the world have already renounced nuclear weapons. You know, there's only 9 nuclear armed states in the world. So we're really talking about a handful of countries that possess the bomb. And then they have some allies that support their possession. And I'm thinking here particularly of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization members. But it's not the majority of countries in the world. Most reject them and believe that nuclear weapons are anathema to security and have grave humanitarian consequences. And so it was these countries, the majority in the world, that came together at the UN globally to think through what it was that could be done around nuclear weapons, and learning from the bans on landmines and cluster bombs that have come earlier, they really saw that the humanitarian effects and environmental effects of weapons were where they needed to focus their attention in order to generate momentum to build up to a prohibition of these weapons.
You know, in this book, I really grasped something that I never gotten quite as clearly before, and that's about how power, that is ascribed to weapons is gendered and the connection to the patriarchy. Can you make that point before we go on?
Absolutely. So as a feminist activist, one of the things that you can sort of start to unpack in your mind when you're confronted with these systems of power is to really look at the ways that gendered norms and constructions frame the way that we see weapons or conflict or security and all of those types of concepts. When I'm talking about gender here and gendered norms, I'm not talking about men versus women and everybody's this way or everybody's that way, but there are social constructions of how we're expected to behave and what we're supposed to think and how we're supposed to act. And it's very gendered and it's very binary also between men and women, and not allowing for gender fluidity or nonconformity in this space. And one of the constructions that a lot of feminist scholars and activists have played with is looking at the ways that those social constructions affect our understanding of weapons and power and violence in the world. And so the construction of a violent masculinity or a militarized masculinity, this idea that you need to be violent and be strong and be willing to take up weapons in order to protect your family or protect your country or whatever the framing is that you're working within, is a social construction that we're all operating within, and it affects the ways in which nuclear weapons are upheld as tools of power and security. And so if you start to deconstruct that from a gender perspective or a feminist perspective, you can understand that nuclear weapons are part of the patriarchal framing of the world and ordering of the world in which these are seen as tools of power, and feminists and others who are contesting that can start unpacking it and help reveal that these are, at the end of the day, weapons that commit mass genocide. You know, these are the most deadly weapons that we've created as human beings, and that's what they actually are, not these abstract tools of deterrence or peace.
So there's this issue of credibility that I think we need to address with about who is the rational actor in all of this, whether it's to retain these weapons for protection, and also the lived experience of after all these years of nuclear colonialism. Can you address that a little more deeply?
Yeah, the credibility question is another thing that the feminist discourse helps get to, because, as you say, there's a question of what's rational when it comes to nuclear weapons. And those who support the abolition of nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament are often treated as if they're irrational. We've been told that we're emotional, which is highly gendered as well in terms of patriarchal discourse that, you know, refutes any kind of argument as being emotional and feminizes it in that way in order to undermine it. So we've had that a lot in our international proceedings to ban nuclear weapons as well, in terms of opposition to banning nuclear weapons. And people who speak from a place of lived experience, whether that's indigenous communities that have been harmed by nuclear testing, or whether it's downwinders, or anybody that's been impacted by the production of nuclear weapons, or whether it's activists more generally who are trying to challenge and deconstruct the notion of nuclear weapons as being necessary for security. All of us are treated as we're not expert and we're not credible. And there's this sense that you need to be, you know, a nuclear physicist in order to have a real policy position, or you need to work in government and wear a suit and tie in order to be a credible interlocutor on the question of nuclear disarmament. And that's just not the case, because, of course, this is more than a technical question. This is a legal, a political, a social, an economic, and a moral question, and everybody can have an opinion about all of those aspects of nuclear weapons.
And so the Non-Proliferation Treaty was started in 1968, and then when the Cold War ended, like after 1991, what did they use to continue to proliferate nuclear arms? And tell us a little more about the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Yeah, so the Non-Proliferation Treaty was really a bargain that was made between the nuclear armed states and non-nuclear countries, which was basically no one else will acquire nuclear weapons, and the states that already have nuclear weapons will eliminate them, will negotiate for nuclear disarmament and achieve nuclear disarmament. But the nuclear armed states have not complied with their end of the bargain. And so proliferation has largely not occurred. The Non-Proliferation Treaty has been very effective in curtailing any kind of proliferation of nuclear weapons. We haven't had massive outbreak of new acquisition of nuclear weapons. But the nuclear armed states have not negotiated an end to their nuclear arsenals, and in fact are violating the treaty right now by investing in what they call modernization of nuclear weapons, which is really just building up their arsenals, building new types of weapons, expanding the size of their arsenals in some cases, spending billions of dollars every year on nuclear weapons to sustain them into the indefinite future. So they're actually going backwards from disarmament rather than towards it. And so that is part of the context in which the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons emerged out of, because you have all of these non-nuclear armed states who can see that they're not upholding their end of the bargain and wanting to put nuclear weapons as an illegal weapon system, the same way that biological, chemical weapons, landmines, cluster bombs have all been prohibited for everybody. And so they wanted to equalize the playing field.
I'm speaking with Ray Acheson, author of Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, and you're here at KZFR Community Radio. This period of resistance, it seems like it really began in earnest with the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War starting ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, in 2007. Can you talk about those roots that you're part of?
Yes, ICANN began in Australia in 2007, founded by the physicians affiliate there, and it grew to be an international campaign, which was always the intention. And it's, you know, its main audience in the very beginning was really medical students, but it was meant to be much broader than that. And the idea was to re-engage a new generation of activists looking at this issue. Because after the Cold War, a lot of the popular momentum for nuclear disarmament, the mass marches that we had, you know, in Central Park in 1982 and throughout the United States, throughout Western Europe, throughout the Pacific, really concerted mass public action for nuclear disarmament. After the Cold War, a lot of that, you know, sort of ebbed and waned. And the idea behind ICANN was to bring some energy back, to focus on nuclear weapons as an urgent threat, to look at the relationship also between nuclear weapons and climate change, and to update a lot of studies that have been done in the 1980s that showed how nuclear weapons would affect the environment, but now adding in all of the understanding that we have of the climate. And so that was sort of the origins of the campaign, and then it really grew into this transnational network. We now have about 600 organizations in over 100 countries around the world that are affiliated with ICANN.
It's just amazing. And you used humor, horror, and hope. I love it. So you used the lessons from the international campaign to ban landmines and also the campaign to rid the earth of cluster munitions. Can you talk about how this campaign was informed by those other campaigns and what has it meant?
Sorry, you broke up a little bit there. I didn't quite hear the question about the relationship.
Yeah, I just wanted to understand how you were informed by these other campaigns that have been successful in banning landmines and cluster munitions.
So one of the first things that we learned and drew on from their experience was this importance of redirecting attention to humanitarian concerns, because the debates on those weapons had also been stuck in kind of the military framing. You know, you'd have military commanders saying these weapons are absolutely instrumental to our strategic, designs for warfare and armed conflict, and we can't give these weapons up. But a group of governments who were concerned with the humanitarian effects of these weapons came together to say that that concern outweighed any kind of military strategy or argument about the necessity of these weapons in use in war. And so a group of governments, cross-regional governments, came together in both cases on landmines and cluster bombs to say enough's enough, and built up really strong alliances with activists and organizers, as well as with survivor groups and communities that were living with cluster bombs and landmines. And so that was another lesson that we learned. Of course, the anti-nuclear movement has always worked with survivors of nuclear weapon use in Japan, as well as nuclear testing around the world, but really trying to center their experiences and their lived reality as the framing for all discussions and actions on nuclear weapons moving forward. That was one of the key takeaways from the previous experiences that we learned.
So the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review came about in 2010, and I think that seems like when this paradigm shift really came on about the humanitarian initiative and became a really serious challenge to the nuclear deterrence. Can you tell our listeners here at KZFR what that was like to be at that review in 2010?
Yeah, it was NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty Review conferences are troubled at the best of times. They seek a consensus outcome, which, given everything I've described so far, should be clear why that's problematic in terms of the tensions between the nuclear armed and the non-nuclear armed countries. But in 2010, there was a new initiative kind of put forward by Switzerland and Norway and Mexico and a few other countries that were really concerned to make sure that humanitarian impacts of nuclear weapons were reflected in the outcome of that review process. And they managed to get a bit of language in the final document that said that nuclear weapon use was not compatible with international humanitarian law, and that it had grave humanitarian impacts. And it was really from that moment on that we were able to run with that language and build up the humanitarian initiative. Coming out of the 2010 review conference, the governments of Norway, then Mexico, and then Austria hosted three conferences that looked specifically at the humanitarian environmental impacts of nuclear weapons and really started taking on the concepts of nuclear deterrence and looking at risk and impacts more than strategy and doctrine. And so that was sort of where the momentum for the Prohibition Treaty built up over many years after the 2010 review conference.
And Ray Acheson, I think it's important when you talk about, in terms of language, about the voices of these smaller countries, global South countries. What was happening during these conferences in terms of how these concerns were being addressed by the nuclear armed states?
Well, the nuclear armed states boycotted the conferences for the most part. The U.S. and the UK showed up to the last one in Austria, and India and Pakistan, also nuclear armed states, they observed a few of the conferences but didn't participate in them directly. And so really I think that helped also in a way to generate momentum for the ban, because it was just so patronizing that the nuclear armed states wouldn't even show up to international conferences that were about their weapons and about the harm that their weapons cause in the world. And so the humanitarian initiative was largely an initiative of the Global South, along with a few European countries like Ireland and Austria and Liechtenstein, who participated very actively and championed the process as well. But other than a few of these European countries, it was mostly Global South that was leading this initiative and raising the alarm about nuclear weapons and forging ahead to pursue a prohibition treaty. And so in that sense as well, one of the things that ICAN as a campaign focused on in terms of, you know, re-energizing the anti-nuclear movement was to also focus on activists within countries of the Global South that maybe hadn't necessarily worked on nuclear weapons before, but that worked on the landmine and cluster bomb treaties and that wanted to get engaged in this process as well, and activists that were concerned with environmental stuff or with uranium mining and other things that do happen on their territory, and really bringing them into the conversation along with the diplomats of the Global South.
So to get to this point, too, there was this focus on international humanitarian law. And I don't think that many people really know what that is about. Can you talk about international humanitarian law and what that is in terms of nuclear weapons?
Yeah, so international humanitarian law is kind of the technical term for the laws of war set up by the Geneva Conventions coming out of World War II, and it was really an attempt by the global community at that time in history to consider that there needed to be some constraints on how militaries could operate during armed conflict, how to deal with prisoners of war, what weapons you could or couldn't use in armed conflict because they're indiscriminate or excessively injurious, which is a technical term which basically means they're really horrible weapons, and weapons around how to deal with, rules around how to deal with surrender, how to deal with civilians that are caught up in the midst of armed conflict, and all of those kinds of things. So international humanitarian law sets out all of those rules of engagement, basically. And the idea with nuclear weapons is that they are the most indiscriminate weapon of all, and yet haven't specifically been outlawed until the Prohibition Treaty under international law, even though other weapons have been categorically prohibited on the basis of non-compliance with international humanitarian law. And so bringing nuclear weapons into that framework and that consideration really helped a lot of countries who do put a lot of stock into the rule of law and into international global governance to think about the ways in which nuclear weapons violate all of that, and really provided them with scope to get their governments to support this treaty prohibiting nuclear weapons.
In your book, Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, you go into a lot of depth about these different conferences and the steps that it took, all these meetings. And I just wanted to, you know, understand a little bit better about something you call the manipulation of consensus. There's so much, so many players in this. Can you talk a little more about the kind of what it was like and who these different countries were? You talked about Austria, Mexico, and Norway and how important they were, but a little more about all these conferences. It's hard to do because it looks like you went through so many pieces and different meetings. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was a long road to the ban, that's for sure, and a lot of basement windowless rooms at the United Nations to get this treaty done. But the manipulation of consensus is really problematic at the UN in a number of forums, not just those dealing with disarmament, but it's certainly been a big issue in our world. And what I mean by that is that rather than treating consensus as a process, you know, a tool that people use in order to reach agreement, certain governments within the United Nations have started treating consensus as meaning absolute unanimity, which basically means that in forums that operate by consensus, that every single participating state gets a veto over anything happening. And this has really stymied a lot of the forums that deal with disarmament issues within the United Nations. There's this body that operates out of the UN in Geneva They haven't even been able to agree on an agenda, on a program of work for more than 20 years. The last treaty they negotiated was the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty back in 1996. That's the last thing this body has been able to do. And it's because of this rule of consensus where every state has a veto. So either the United States doesn't let something happen, or Russia doesn't let something happen, or Pakistan doesn't let something happen. And it comes down to just the same handful of countries over and over again that are refusing to allow progress. And so what I try and argue in the book is that instead of looking at consensus as unanimity and requiring everyone to be in agreement, which just always results in the lowest common denominator or absolutely nothing happening at all, we need to go back to the original intention of consensus, which is as process, as a way to dialogue with each other and cooperate and compromise and move forward as collectively as possible, but at the end of the day, not letting one or two countries hold us up from doing anything.
Yeah, you talk about the tyranny of the minority, and that seems like it's been true at the UN for a while. I wanted to find out more about who you were. You have just a beautiful description, and I love the fact that it was the International Red Cross, the Pope, so many different people. But who else were involved?
So we had our massive global campaign of activist groups around the world, with ICANN, of course, and the International Committee of the Red Cross was very involved, as well as national Red Cross societies from some countries, and diplomats and government officials from the global south were very active as well, and it really was a transnational global effort to make this happen, and building up that kind of community of trust and sort of co-conspirators in the effort to ban nuclear weapons over the objections of the nuclear armed states was really an extraordinary thing to be part of. And what I really hope by writing this book, but also by continuing this work in other campaigns on other weapons issues and other movements more broadly, is that those lessons of community building, which is kind of smaller than movement building, but part of the same effort, is really that, individuals do make things happen, but only by working together. And so that's kind of one of the main messages of the book that I hope really comes through.
Yeah, it did. It's wonderful. So I'm speaking with Ray Atchison. Ray is the author of Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, and also a very pivotal person, according to the book's foreword is written by, I'm going to say her name wrong, Setsuko Thurlow, and she gives Ray much credit here for their organizational skills and just being a leader in the ICANN movement. And I'm grateful to have you with us today here at KZFR Community Radio. So you also are self-critical during this about who wasn't as involved, what the failings were of the ICANN effort. Can you mention that too?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do try and be honest about struggles that we faced internally in the campaign, mostly around decision-making structures and sort of policy setting within the campaign, which was largely led by a small staff team and an international steering group. And a lot of those organizations were dominated by Western Europeans, North Americans, not representative of the diversity in the larger campaign, which had a lot of organizations and actions going on in the global south, but weren't necessarily represented at the steering group level. And so I do try and be honest about that accounting, and also struggles that we faced in terms of making decisions on the fly once negotiations started, how we dealt with, you know, the sort of transparency and democracy within something that's very fast moving when decisions have to be made in an instant, basically. And so, yeah, all struggles that are common, I think, to any movement or organization even, or certainly a global coalition where you have so many different parts and people involved. And I'm hoping that by being honest about the struggles that we faced, that can also be lessons to future activists and organizers who are engaging in any kind of social justice work.
So it sounds like in 2013, there was the first articulation of what the treaty would entail, but a lot of countries were sort of waiting on the 2015 Nuclear Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. What was that like in 2015 when that conference turned out to be a dud?
It did provide a lot of momentum then for countries to get more supportive of a treaty prohibiting nuclear weapons. I don't think that many countries expected a great outcome from 2015, but I also don't think they expected it to be a total failure, and they certainly recognized at that point that there was very little opportunity for progress by the nuclear armed states to actually be leaders and comply with their obligations for nuclear disarmament. And so the failure of that conference enabled a lot of governments to say, okay, this is the turning point for us, and we now need to support the Prohibition Treaty wholeheartedly. And then really that from there, we were able to get things rolling in 2016 and then the negotiations happening in 2017. So for all the work that went in to build up to that moment, to get governments to be prepared to say yes and to move on this, then it was quite quick after that, in UN terms, to get the treaty negotiated and adopted.
And I'd like you to tell our listeners, too, about some of this racist and sexist bullying that went on during this period.
So the sexist approach I'd sort of mentioned earlier with this, you know, the kind of comments about diplomats as well as activists, you know, who supported the ban treaty as being irrational and emotional, a lot of comments in that regard that were, you know, really patriarchal and patronizing. And then the racist critiques of the movement to ban nuclear weapons is really because the nuclear armed states really bullied countries in Latin America and in Africa and Southeast Asia to stop supporting the treaty, because most of the countries supporting this initiative were from the global south. They were targeted. And, you know, France targeted its former colonies, and the Brits and the Americans were bullying others as well to drop this, not support it, making high-level phone calls, threatening with economic, not sanctions, but threatening economic trade deals and things like that, and saying, you know, this might be in jeopardy if you pursue this. You should stay away from the negotiations, or you shouldn't vote for its adoption. And then once we had the treaty, it was, well, you shouldn't sign it, you shouldn't ratify it. And then at the, you know, the very last minute before the treaty reached the requisite 50 ratifications to enter into force this year, the Trump administration that was in power at that point sent a memo to countries saying that they'd made a mistake in ratifying the treaty and should unratify it, which, as far as we know, is an unprecedented move for any U.S. administration to declare that other countries have made a strategic error in, you know, adopting national legislation. And it's also just so incredible, considering that these countries are saying we reject nuclear weapons and we'll never acquire them, and binding themselves to never acquiring nuclear weapons. And the U.S. government and the French government as well, and other nuclear armed states are saying, no, you shouldn't do that. And it's because they understand the pressure of stigmatization, that the more and more countries join on to this treaty, the more pressure they will come under to disarm from their publics, from parliamentarians, from financial institutions, and from all sides to disarm. And so that's where the kind of nuclear colonial critique really comes in into play, as well as just where they thought that they could stop this treaty, and they did not succeed.
Yay. Yeah. And also you mentioned Australia's role in that, trying to derail the ban prior to it being voted on in the General Assembly in 2017. And then you said, and I was so happy, Guatemala saved the day, opening the way to the vote. And if anything ever made me happy, it was that. It was so exciting. So what I want to know is, when you talk about getting your ban on, I know there was a lot of discussion about what was in and what was out of this treaty. Can you talk about a little of the process and what the treaty contains? We have about 3 minutes left.
Okay. In 3 minutes or less, the treaty provides categorical prohibition on all nuclear weapon activities. So it prohibits development, testing, use, threat of use, possession, stockpiling, sharing, stationing. It's very comprehensive in that way. We wanted explicit prohibitions on financing nuclear weapons and on transiting nuclear weapons, but those are, while not named specifically, they're considered to be included in the prohibitions on assistance with nuclear weapons, which are prohibited in the treaty. The treaty also has some positive obligations to it. So it is the first nuclear weapons agreement to acknowledge harm to indigenous communities and to survivors of nuclear weapons use and testing, and to require states to provide assistance to affected communities, to victims, and also has environmental remediation provisions as well. And then the final thing that the treaty does is provide scope for the nuclear armed states to join and to negotiate the disarmament of their programs, but it leaves that to when we'll actually be dealing with the nuclear armed states, rather than setting it out in this treaty itself, because they're, of course, going to want to be involved in that process.
My last question is about what work needs to be done for compliance. I know that's not a one-minute answer, but go ahead.
Well, the states parties of the treaty so far are all in compliance with the treaty, and we anticipate that will continue to be the case going forward. In terms of universalizing the treaty and getting the nuclear armed states on board, we're putting our attention really into the economic divestment, because the military-industrial complex is obviously a big piece of this, especially in the United States, with the nuclear weapon-producing companies being private companies that are contracted by the government. And so we're trying to affect that the same way that there's fossil fuel divestment and other divestment initiatives. We're doing the same now very effectively already with nuclear weapons. So that's a big part of our efforts. And then also in changing the policies of some of the nuclear armed state allies is another area that we're putting a lot of attention on. So the NATO countries and Australia and others, where they don't have nuclear weapons but support other countries possessing them.
I want to thank you so much, Rae Acheson. And this book, Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, was important for me to read. And I was wondering how people can get hold of it or learn more about you and your work, or I can.
The best way to get a hold of the book is to purchase direct from the publisher, Roman and Littlefield. It's available online. Also, asking your local bookstores to order it, that is great, and asking your libraries to order it is also great. Helps get it out to more and more people. In terms of finding out more about ICANN, you can go to icannw.org. And in terms of finding out more about my group, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, you can go to WILPF.org.
Thank you for being with me today on the Peace and Justice Program, and thank you for being alive and doing the work you do. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye, Rae.
Bye.
All right. We're going to go on to our next guest, and I want to put on a little song for you to transition us. Here we go.
Robbing us blind. You are stealing the future from our kids and our elders. No food and no shelter, you and your kind. You are robbing us blind. You are robbing us blind with your infatuation with power and wealth. You're a curse on our nation, you and your kind. You are robbing us blind. You are robbing us blind. Fear is your weapon. You hold us all hostage with your manipulation. You are robbing us blind. Your paid mercenaries protect all your interests. Your dogs bite our bodies. You and your kind. You are robbing us blind. You are trying to shatter health care for millions, to lower the tax rates of those who have billions. Corporate prisoners make profits so sweet. You don't count the cost of the misery you reap, you and your kind. You are robbing us blind. You are teaching our kids to be cogs in machines. You deny art and music. You shatter their dreams. You blame natives and Muslims, Hispanics and blacks with their blood on your teeth and your knife in their backs. You and your kind.
All right, that is Linda Allen singing the news. And I have on the line with me Bruce McLean. He is on the board of the local Butte County Healthcare Coalition, North State Medicare for All, and the statewide Healthy California Now Coalition for Single Payer. He's going to give us an overview on the statewide movement for implementation of the statewide Medicare for All system in California, because we need this. Go ahead, Bruce. Welcome to KZFR.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for inviting me. Well, you know, Martin Luther King said something to the effect that the worst civil rights is when people are denied medical care. And that's really what's part of the national and statewide single-payer movement for healthcare, universal healthcare that is funded publicly, and with the government being the single payer and eliminating profit motive of healthcare is all about. I was up in Shasta County, up in Redding, with the California Nurses Association, who were doing an informational picket in front of Shasta medical clinic where they work, and their theme was they wanted to have safe staffing levels. They're negotiating right now, and they're negotiating with a very hardball privately owned hospital chain. And when they say safe staffing levels, it has very much to do with the idea of having patients over profits, which is one of their themes. Now in California, it's really an exciting time regarding single payer because our governor, when he was running for election, said that he wanted to see California be the first state in the nation that would have single payer. Well, he's our governor now. He's had his governor's commission on Healthy California going for about a year and a half, and although I will admit, first year it didn't look promising at all for single payer, things have dramatically changed, and he has his Secretary of Health and Human Resources, Secretary Gailey, chairing the meeting, and he's taken a very active role in the last couple of monthly meetings, and the whole range of topics about single payer and implementing in California and the financing of it are being looked at with some depth. And we believe that he's doing this because he's responding to the governor's desires, and the governor's desires are responding in part to the pressure that the single payer movement, including labor unions and physicians and nurses and normal people, average citizens like ourselves, have been putting on and voicing the absolute need for it. And of course, the COVID pandemic has shown that we all need access to health care. Everybody who lives here, whether you're documented, undocumented, doesn't matter. In a pandemic, you're only as safe as your neighbor is. And if your neighbor doesn't have access to good medical care, it keeps you also unsafe.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I mean, everyone, I'm a provider, and I see how piecemeal services are because of insurance. You know, how you can't do anything comprehensive because, oh no, that program doesn't pay for that, or oh no, we don't take that funding or whatever. So people don't get services. It's very, very hard. A lot of work to try to piece together just simple things. And now I worry about these people that are going to have these huge bills from being, you know, hospitalized during COVID. Do you think there's a timeline for the governor's actions or for the legislature to get something going?
Yeah, that's a good question. Last February, a bill called AB 1400 was submitted to the assembly, state assembly. It was written by the California Nurses Association and Ash Kalra, a very progressive assemblyman from the San Jose area, carried the bill and had 19 co-sponsors when it was submitted. At that point, unfortunately, the governor had not taken a clear position. We were in the midst of the pandemic, and actually that was taking up most of his attention regarding health care. And there are some well-known state legislators. They're Democrats, but they receive a lot of money from the tripartite current health care for-profit system. That would be the for-profit hospitals, the pharmaceutical manufacturers, and the health insurance. I use that term loosely, but the for-profit health insurance companies. Mm-hmm. They're all opposed, obviously, to instituting single payer.
Yeah.
But this bill is being re-proposed again in February, and there may be need for some modification. Some of the unions who support single payer want to see a few changes made. They've worked really hard to get good health care, and they want to make sure that this health care is going to be as good as what they've gotten for their members. But they also realize that there are so many other people who don't have it that it needs to be gotten for everybody.
Yeah, and I appreciated that you went up to Reading, or you and some others went up to Reading to support the nurses, because safe staffing is critical, and where you don't have enough nurses or other health ancillary staff, the patients don't get good care, and people end up having terrible results as a result. And so that was a great thing that you guys did, and, you know, brought to my mind how important it is to support you. So that's why I wanted to have you on today. Is there an ask for our listeners as my last question to you, Bruce McLean?
Yeah, I'd ask that. I know there's a lot going on, especially here in Chico, but think about spending a little time and energy on the whole issue of single payer. There is a very strong movement on our website at North State Medicare, and then the number 4 all gives information as well as contact information, an easy way for you to become a member of our organization, get on our mailing list, and upcoming events. And we're going to be showing the civil rights Medicare for All film called Power to Heal, narrated by Danny Glover, which shows the intersection between how the advent of Medicare desegregated the medical facilities, especially in the South, that were completely segregated.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting documentary. We're negotiating now with Simon Place that we're hopefully going to be showing it at Trinity Methodist Church here in Chico in the near future, and we will have that information on our website.
Well, thanks so much for being my guest today on the Peace and Justice Show, Bruce. Keep up the good work. We appreciate you.
Hey, Chris. We appreciate you, and you keep up the good work, too.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, listeners, stay tuned for Playing Dead, and after that devastation sounds, I'm going to go out with the community calendar, but I would like to encourage you to support our underwriters. They've been through a tough time, and now is the time to, you know, as we kind of lift our heads up, to look out there and see what's out there that needs our support, one of which is Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org, also on Facebook, and at 762-1490. And also Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For details, see squaredealmattress.com. Stay tuned for the community calendar, and thank you. Have peace. Do good work. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Hey, listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. Chico Friends of the Library hold the book sale every Saturday. This event is held in the Chico Library Meeting Room from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m., and book prices range from 25 cents to $2. This is the library's main source of income, is run by volunteers, and proceeds from the book sale benefit the Chico Library completely. To donate books for the sale, you can bring in clean books to the Chico Library at East 1st Avenue at Sherman anytime, or you can visit the sale every Saturday from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Join your local friends at the new amphitheater in Riverbend Park for the 2021 Summer Concerts in the Park series, sponsored by Oroville Hospital. They are excited to announce the return of these free admission community events. There are food trucks and local vendors starting at 4 p.m., and the live music starts at 6:30 until 8 p.m. These are held every Friday evening until August 13th at the Riverbend Park in Oroville. If you have an event you'd like on the community calendar, let me know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar.
That's right. Thank you, Megan, for the community calendar. My name's Ray. I will be your host today here on Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon from 1 till 3, followed by Devastation Sounds, of course. It's Killer Friday here in the Ishy North State, True North, we like to call it, broadcasting from Chico, California. A little smoky today. Wind has shifted a little bit, so it's kind of gray out there. Not too smelly, but definitely different. We've been very lucky in the last 10 days or so since the fire started up in Plumas County that the smoke has gone somewhere else. Looks like we're going to get some today. Got a fun show for you. Let's see, 1994, 26 years ago, something like that. Let's see, 94, 2004, 2014, 27 years ago, and a couple days passed. 7/20/94, Deer Creek Music Center, Noblesville, Indiana. Did three days there. And some killer stuff, some new stuff. I just listened to it the other day, and I thought, what the heck? I've been playing all this 80s and 70s stuff, so let's kick it out. Some nice innovative versions, some newer songs, new to me, newer songs. And hope everybody's digging it. Let's get right to it. Oh, let's thank some underwriters first. That's right, we got to thank our underwriters. Oh, yeah, we've got some exciting underwriters, too. We want to thank KZFR supporters and also the Days Between Festival, celebrating the music of Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead at Black Oak Ranch in Laytonville. Performers include two nights of Dark Star Orchestra, the David Nelson Band, Moon Alice, Stu Allen and Friends, and more on Saturday and Sunday, August 6th and 7th. Tickets and details, including camping, at daysbetweenfestival.com. Sounds like a big, big event. There's a lot of different bands, too. Too numerous to mention. And we also want to thank M&M Real Estate, offering a caring, comprehensive approach with efficient service, straightforward communication, and transparency. For more information about buying or selling your home or its value, visit ChicoForeverHome.com or at 530-321-3785. M&M Real Estate, providing a guiding hand for their clients and our community. All right, here we go. Childhood's End.